This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashrin Johan. Reverend Dr. Manta Isaac is a Palestinian Christian theologian, academic, and activist. He has written extensively on issues related to theology and politics in the Middle East, and is an advocate for peace and justice in the region. Reverend Manta joins me on the show today to discuss the ongoing genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza, Palestine, by the Zionist Israel regime, and how Palestinian Christians are often left out of the conversation to fit the narrative of Western powers. As always, this conversation is also available as a podcast. You can find us Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Reverend Manta, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start by just getting to know you. Tell me, who is Reverend Manta? Where are you from? Where did you grow up?
So I'm a Palestinian and a Palestinian Christian. I was raised in a town called Beit Sahur next to Bethlehem, known also as the Shepherd's Field. This is home to me. And after studying civil engineering, I studied theology, and I wanted to be in to serve God, as I put it. I sense His calling. So I have studied theology and came back, and I've been teaching theology in Bethlehem, and also I am pastoring two evangelical Lutheran churches here in Bethlehem. So this is home. I'm speaking to you from Bethlehem. I'm literally 5 minutes away from where Jesus was born. And maybe this is a little known fact to many. It comes as a surprise that there are Palestinian Christians, yet this is where it all started. Definitely, this is where, you know, this is Jesus's home as well.
You say this is Jesus's home, and it certainly is. But many people tend to frame what is going on in Palestine right now and over the past several decades as a religious battle between the Muslims and the Jews. How would you frame it?
I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions about the reality here. And there are always, you know, I say about among the many misconceptions, at least two. The first is that this is a religious conflict. And the second is that this is actually a conflict. So let me explain. This is definitely not a religious conflict between Jews and Muslims. Portraying it as such gives the impression that Jews and Muslims have long existed here and couldn't get along. This is not the reality. And at its core, it's a political conflict. And the second misconception is that it's actually a conflict because we're dealing with colonization. We're dealing with the Zionist colonization of our land. We as Palestinians, Christians, Muslims, and Jews lived in this land for years. And then the disruption happened is when Zionist Jews immigrated from Europe to Palestine with the intention of establishing a home for the Jewish people, not just in our land, but literally on the ruins and towns of our town, on the ruins of our towns and villages. Israel was created as a state on the ruins of Palestinian towns and villages. For that to happen, Palestinians were displaced. The indigenous people of the land, the Palestinians, were displaced, including Palestinian Christians. And this is where it all started. And right now, to talk about the conflict, there is no conflict because there is an occupying power that has created the system of apartheid. There is one state that is Israel, and there is a people who are seeking independence and liberation and to live in dignity on their land. And those people, the Palestinians, include Christians. So portraying it as a Jewish-Muslim conflict or a religious conflict is dangerous because it puts religions in conflict. And it's also misguided, and it serves the agenda of those who want to, if you wish, make it as a problem between good and evil with, you know, the tension between civilizations, the clash of civilizations, with one civilization being the civilized, the Christian Judaic tradition versus Arabs and Muslims, we are here to say, no, this is not true. This is the wrong characterization. And it's actually wrong to talk about this clash of civilization.
How diverse is Palestine today? Because again, a lot of people who consume Western mainstream media as their primary way of looking at the world, again, Palestine is often painted as this monolith. There's just so quote unquote one type of people. How diverse is Palestine?
So before the creation of Israel, we were actually even more diverse. There were Muslims, Christians and Jews and Samaritans and Baha'is and Druze and many, many groups of people who lived in this region. Right now, when you talk about Palestinians, remember that Palestinians, the majority of us live in the diaspora, especially Palestinian Christians, because we've been displaced because of the different wars, especially after 1948 and 67. Right now, the majority, of course, are Muslims. And in the Palestinian occupied territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, Christians make only 1%. We were much, much more than that. But our numbers continue to decline because of the policies of occupation. Yet even within the Palestinian community, it's important to highlight that we are diverse politically, culturally even. I mean, we're one people, one language, but, there are more religious, there are some secular, there are those who are very left-wing and so on. Like all people, we're diverse in our worldviews.
What is your earliest memory, Reverend? And I just want to give people more perspective about, you know, what you saw growing up and how that shaped your worldviews. Talk to me about what it was like growing up as a child, early conversations with parents. How does a parent tell you what situation their homeland is in right now? How do they have these conversations?
So when I was 8 years old, the first Intifada started. And the first Intifada was a monumental event in the life of Palestinians. So what I remember too well is the demonstrations outside of the streets, the grassroots movements that happened in Palestine, the whole people coming together, the curfews when we could not leave the house because we were under the rule of the military completely. You know, there was no Palestinian Authority back then. There was no self-rule as we have now. And the Israeli military was the ultimate authority. Demonstrations and curfews were part of our lives. I was once, I still remember, slapped on the face by an Israeli soldier. We fear the soldiers. We fear the soldiers a lot. And schools were closed. When we did then is homeschooling, we would gather in our neighborhoods and continue education by ourselves. It was a time when we came together as Palestinians and really created a sense of unity among the Palestinian people. So you don't need to be reminded that you are occupied in Palestine. The occupation really determines every aspect of our lives. They control us. They control everything. And the sad reality, Dashran, is that the situation on the ground actually keeps getting worse. So when I talk about the first Intifada, actually things are worse now in terms of restrictions, mobility, where we can build, where we can live, the roads we control. And the most important thing, the Israeli colonies on our lands that are built on land confiscated from us that make life here very, very difficult for us as Palestinians. And as I said, for us Palestinians, even today, the Israeli occupation controls every aspect of our lives.
Reverend, how do you contend with the narratives of evangelical Christians from the West? Because it's not just Jewish people who support Zionism. And I want to stress that, right? It's not all Jewish people. It's not people who support Zionism. It's not just them who, believe in the Zionist project, who thinks that, Israel has a right to exist where it is and displace Palestinians and all of that, right? It's also the evangelical Christians. They quote the Old Testament. They tell stories about how when all the Jewish people have been brought to Israel or Palestine, the Lord Jesus Christ will be reborn again and things like that. How do you contend with these narratives?
To begin with, if we're able to have a Christian conversation, I could just point, this is the wrong interpretation. Where did you get this? But then on the other levels, what's really sad about all of these things is how much dismissive are these views of Middle Eastern Christians and Palestinian Christians in particular. It's as if we don't exist. They talk about the land as if it's empty. They have created this imaginary view of the land, which was barren and desolate and a desert only for the Jews, the same people who were dismissed 2,000 years ago to come, quote unquote, back to their land. And even such a language that Jews returned to their land gives the impression that, we as the indigenous people here, we've been living here for generations, are actually occupying someone else's land. Hmm. So without realizing, and maybe with realizing, and I don't want to continue to treat it as a fault of, an innocent mistake, what they're doing is promoting a view in which a Jewish person in Russia, because of his Jewishness, have more right to come and live in this land and have more right than the indigenous people, including the Palestinian Christian community. And all of this is translated into policies because Israel continues to do what it's doing. Look at the war in Gaza now. They're committing obvious war crimes. Why? Because they are enabled. And they continue to be enabled and given the cover and the narrative. And we are appalled that this is done by churches. Churches who are dismissing our presence, dismissing our plight, and posing an existential threat to our existence. The Christian community right now is facing extinction. Sadly, this war will most likely bring an end to Christianity in Gaza, one of the oldest Christian communities in the world. But in the minds of many Western Christians, what matters most is for Israel to kill everyone, or to completely get rid of Gazans. They don't see us. They don't see us. And maybe one more thing. I'm convinced that at the heart of it, racism is a key element in this. Because they don't look at us as equal. Even as Middle Eastern Christians, they don't look at us as equals. To them, there is a certain agenda. There is a certain interest. Israel serves the interest of the United States, makes it richer and more successful. So it serves their interest. So that's more important than the actual plight and presence of Palestinians and Palestinian Christians.
You mentioned something very powerful there, and you said it's as if we don't exist. You were referring to Palestinian Christians. Do you think that a lot of these messaging comes from the position of Western imperial interests rather than genuine religious conviction, especially from the grassroots?
Yes, and it's a combination of both, but it's a big mistake to look at it purely as religious interpretation. I don't think it is purely that. The religious interpretation comes to the aid, and all people of different religions are good in making texts say what they want them to say. But certainly what I talk about as coloniality is involved. Israel serves the interests of world powers today, with its strong military ties, economic ties, IT ties. Many have described Israel as a military base for the United States. So it's definitely that. And when you think of the American nationalism In that, there is the idea of support to Israel is embedded in it. It's part of the identity there. And as such, they don't see us because their main concern is their interest. One of the things I've discovered over the years of doing advocacy and speaking to church leaders, but also to politicians, is that it's not a matter of knowledge. They know what's wrong. They know what's just. They know what's right. But it's mainly interest-based politics. I was recently in England, and I said this. I said, what politicians lack today more than anything is integrity and morality, because I'm convinced that they understand too well. For example, does the world really need proof that Israel is committing war crimes? I mean, it's there for everyone to see.
We are watching it in real time.
We watch it in real time, both by the people of Gaza who are sacrificing everything to show it to us, but also by the Israeli soldiers themselves. The Israeli military leaders told us what they want to do, and they're doing it. The whole idea of preventing food from entering Gaza, I mean, how dehumanizing, and what level of racism behind all of this, to the extent that now we're just begging and negotiating and arguing and deliberating to get food into Gaza. People are literally starving. So it's not as if people don't know and politicians don't know, but they lack the integrity and courage and morality to exercise their power and hold Israel accountable for the war crimes it is committing. And what's really sad is that we see the same world powers react swiftly in other places. But when it comes to Palestinians, no, they deliberate, they justify, they rationalize. This is why I've been saying throughout this war that this war has confirmed to us that they don't see us as equals. They don't look at Palestinians as equals. 30,000 precious lives have been lost so far. Were killed in this war, including 13,000 children and many more under the rubble. And we're still not able to bring a ceasefire into effect.
On the show with me today is Reverend Dr. Mantha Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, academic, and activist. We will continue our conversation after the break. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Reverend Dr. Mantha Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, academic, and activist. And we're talking about freedom and liberation for Palestine. This conversation will also be available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you're listening to this on Spotify, do give us a follow and drop us a review. It would be really, really helpful. So, Reverend, how do you view the Zionist project?
I don't think it's a matter of perspective and how one sees it. It's facts. Israel as a state was created as a settler colonial entity. Who started Israel? It's the people who came from Europe. And where was it when they had and they did expel Palestinians to live in their land? This is why we call it settler colonial entity, which is a bit different than settler colonialism, which is destroy to replace. This is how some scholars describe it. Now, they could say that it's a Jewish homeland and they could go to religious texts, which is strange because right now, this is the only context around the world that is being in which colonialism is justified with the religious text. And oppression is justified because, you know, we've had other examples in the past, and maybe religious texts were used, whether slavery, apartheid, United States settler colonial project. But now it's the only place where it's being used, even by those who claim to hold human rights and so on. And the whole idea of creating a safe homeland for the Jewish people, which is something that Biden recently repeated, If I was a genuine and concerned Jewish leader, I would be concerned because the message Biden is spreading and this narrative is spreading is that Jews can't be safe anywhere else in the world except in Palestine.
Right.
Really? Really? I mean, are you telling us that we should accept anti-Semitism to continue to exist all over the world? And that the only way for Jews to be safe is for them to replace other people and create a military state that exercises what many have described as an apartheid regime. And don't take the Palestinians' word. Many have said this is apartheid, including Israeli human rights organization. So are we really to believe that Jews are destined to be persecuted around the world and are not, you know, that United States and UK and Europe are not able to protect them unless they displace some other people and create a Jewish state in the Middle East? Really? I mean, do we listen to ourselves? Are we listening to what we're saying? Are we really understanding? And to be very clear, I'm not calling for Jews to now leave Palestine and to dismiss and, you know, destroy Israel or any of that, or kill all the Jewish people. I'm just challenging the premise because it's a dangerous premise. And now that they have created Israel here, they have to decide how to share the land with the indigenous people, the Palestinians. And it's up to the occupying power. They either go back to the two-state solution or just allow us to be equal citizens of their state. I don't see any other way forward. It's a very, very simple. The current status quo is not sustainable. And I think, going back to your question, it's time that we rise on the offense and challenge the Zionist narrative, the dominant narrative, which is prevalent in Western media. Which is sadly, and I have to confess here, it's prevalent in many Western churches and by extension to many churches in the Global South because of the strong ties churches in the Global South and in some cases dependent relationship on the more wealthy churches in the North. It's time to challenge that narrative. And it's time that we claim the moral and ethical credibility and integrity as those survivors of colonialism and discrimination and racism, and speak out against those who claim to be the protectors of values and human rights and freedom, because obviously this is all nonsense, to be honest. You know, this war, among the many things, is the collapse of the Western human rights matrix. I don't want to hear about it anymore, especially from white Westerns.
Absolutely. It's such a facade. And I love that you brought up that these are facts. It's not about a point of view, two sides of the story, so on and so forth, right? And I just want to bring up this quote by Noam Chomsky, you know, where he said, "European settlers coming to a foreign land, settling there, and either committing genocide against or expelling the indigenous people. The Israeli Zionists have not invented anything new in this respect. The last paradox is that the tale of Palestine from the beginning until today is a simple story of colonialism and dispossession. Yet the world treats it as a multifaceted and complex story, hard to understand and even harder to solve." And I think it is, you know, it's a very, very powerful quote there by Noam Chomsky. Reverend, could you share? I want to move on to very contemporary times, as in over the past couple of weeks, few weeks. Could you share your observations on the ground? What have you witnessed, seen or heard from your friends, your family, your community, especially over the past couple of weeks?
What people don't realize is that, and many people don't realize, is that here in Palestine, Israel has managed to fragment us into isolated blocks. So we're isolated from Gaza. I wish we could go there. Honestly, even in these circumstances, I would want to stand in solidarity with our people there. And one of the biggest tragedies is that people are dying without having normal funerals or goodbyes or people are being killed in horrific ways, and their loved ones here in the West Bank say, we wish we could even say goodbye. And this has been the case for years now. Gaza is completely isolated from the West Bank, as in the rest of the world. And even communication right now is difficult. We have friends in Gaza that we try to keep in touch with. Internet is not stable, phones are not stable, and news are rare, especially from the center and north of Gaza. In Rafah, you get more updates. But in the center of Gaza, and this is where right now the majority of the Christian community with whom we are in touch are still in the heart of the city of Gaza. And they are telling us of new, if you wish, new stages of this genocide, namely lack of food and clean water and any medical services. People are not just killed from the bombardment and the snipers. They're now being killed from starvation and lack of medical attention. Even some people we know in the Christian community, you know, if you get sick right now in Gaza, chances are very high you will not survive it because there are no medicine, no medical care. It's beyond horrific. And it's, you know, it's literally, you know, horror stories and hell on earth. At a certain stage, they were telling us, you know, they couldn't leave the church compounds. And then now that they left, they realized their homes are destroyed. There were so many dead bodies in the streets. They are traumatized. And, you know, on top of all of this, have to think of the uncertainty if they survive. And it's a big if, unfortunately. We're praying, we're doing our best that they this is over. But if they survive, will they have a future in Gaza with the destruction of their homes? How long would it take to rebuild Gaza? Will Israel allow, you know, building material to enter into? Israel's, you know, completely destroyed it. So what's the future? No one knows. So these uncertainties and fears, our fear is that it will add and create generational traumas that will take years to recover and deal with. Right now, we just wish for this war to end. That's all we're asking for.
Recently, there was a brutal massacre, you know, and it's now being dubbed the Fla massacre, in which Palestinians were killed in cold blood by IDF soldiers while trying to get food. What are your thoughts on this?
It's a painful, painful image and reality. For someone to die just trying to get food. And I can't imagine, you know, can you think of the level of dehumanization that it takes, that it took for a situation in which the whole world is not able to make Israel allow humanitarian aid and food to enter into Gaza, to the extent that people are willing to jump at trucks bringing minimum food because they know it's not enough. And then when they were shot at, this tragedy happened. I mean, can you think of a worst, least dignifying way to die? By trying to get just food. The things we're saying is that they're not trying to get food for themselves, but for their children. They're trying to provide and find ways to get food for their children and loved ones. They're trying to break us. And I think this is what's happening. They're trying to break the Palestinians into surrender. And I look from here, from some distance, and I'm horrified because I know that Israel is willing to do whatever it takes to break the Palestinians. So I'm horrified by how many more will need to die. You know, and if you look at the progression of this war, we thought they would not attack the churches. They did. We thought they would not attack the hospitals. They did. We thought they would not attack the south. They did. We thought they will not allow people to die from starvation. They did. How much more? You know, we thought, you know, children is a red line. No, 13,000 children have been killed. So how much more will Israel continue to push and do to Palestinians? And of course, the answer is, as long as they're never held accountable, they'll do whatever they want. And the amount of dehumanization that had to take place for the world to be okay with this genocide is horrifying to me. How much racism is involved? So I continue to repeat, they don't look at us as equals. This is the really horrifying. And when you don't look at people as equals, you can say and claim and support all sorts of things. Look at the nonsense justification of killing Palestinians by saying it's Hamas' fault for taking them as human shields. And I say nonsense because would you accept in America or in England for your government to bomb a school and kill everybody so that they kill a serial killer who hid in that school? Would you accept that? And of course, you know, you would not accept it unless you're talking about maybe animals. And even then, the animal rights group will protest. But it's being circulated all over the media. It's Hamas's fault for talking Palestinians as human shields, which means it's okay. Let's bomb the school, or to kill one Hamas militant, let's kill 100 Palestinians. That's fine. That's acceptable. That's morally justifiable, and they blame Hamas for it. It's unbelievable to me. It's unbelievable.
How do you contextualize, you know, the whole Hamas situation? Because, you know, the West has this been obsessed with Hamas over the past few years, especially the past few months. You know, over the past few months, every time a Palestinian guest goes on Western mainstream media, do you condemn Hamas? Do you condemn Hamas? Do you condemn Hamas? That's all. And they just go around in circles. How do you contextualize that? How do you look at the whole situation? Because it's not just Hamas. Palestine is a diverse political landscape. They have many resistance fighters. This is a settler colonialism. Of course, there's going to be armed resistance against settler colonialism.
So the question, do you condemn Hamas, I believe, is an attempt to say that, to claim that this war began on October 7th. This is the whole reason behind it. It's as if October 7th is the problem, Hamas is the problem, which ignores 75 years of occupation, oppression. So this is why there's this obsession with the question, do you condemn Hamas? I'm a pastor. I believe in nonviolence. I've written a lot about this. This is, you know, to me, the way of liberation. I can't accept killing children, regardless of who they are, of course. And of course, as you said, the Palestinian society is diverse. Not everybody's Hamas. The idea that they elected Hamas. I mean, Hamas did not sweep the elections. And this happened 20 years ago. And many who voted for Hamas because of their dissatisfaction from the other secular group, Fatah. And there are, as I said, left-wing, very liberal groups in Palestine. Hamas is one portion of the Palestinian people. And maybe one more thing as an introduction is that, as a background, I don't believe in the concept of a religious state. I think a state should be a state for all people. So I have ideological differences with Hamas. But at the end of the day, Hamas is part of the Palestinian people, and Hamas is a resistance group. If you want to get rid of Hamas, get rid of the occupation, you'll get rid of Hamas. And before, you know, everybody has jumped to demonize Hamas and what happened. And again, I can't justify killing children or kidnapping children. I'm very honest about it. But before people do that, I would like to suggest that you come and live under the siege Gaza lived under, having been displaced from your own town and village 70 years ago, and then live under such a brutal siege in which the amounts of calories were calculated that enter Gaza. People were living in a sense of despair. And I tell many Europeans and Americans who ask me, I say, I don't want you to live 17 years under this siege. I want you to live 17 months. And then I want to say how you will react. And then I will say, I want to say how you will respond. I've heard many people use metaphors that actually are helpful. You know, what many African slaves did to their owners during the fight against slavery. Or even the indigenous people did to the settler colonials. My suspicion is that people will look back at these incidents and say, you know, and this is the sad part, is that this could have been avoided. We saw it coming, and we said, this status quo is not sustainable. You can't dehumanize and oppress people like this. Some people said this is a pressure cooker, you know? And ultimately, this is what happened on October 7th. And for the 100th time, I'm not for armed, you know, or for violence or for killing innocent people. But if we fail to contextualize October 7th, I believe we're doing it for a reason, which is demonizing Palestinians and making it all the Palestinians' fault and completely shifting the narrative and ignoring the 75 years that preceded October 7th, and certainly the 17 years that preceded October 7th, or 16 years of a brutal, inhuman siege against Gaza.
Reverend, what does peace and justice for Palestine look like for you?
Ending the occupation and ending apartheid. Let's put it this way first. Only after we do that, we can think of a political solution. We can think of the nuances of the political. And when I say ending apartheid, it's ending the pretext that assumes that certain people are superior or privileged than others. Which, by the way, is not something I claim Israel does. It's what Israel says it is all about. The nation state law says that the right for self-determination is exclusive to the Jewish people only. So you have in the Israeli law already the pretext for discrimination. Unless we look at each other as equals, I don't think there's any future in this land. And for someone like me, you know, I'm not a politician, and I continue to be, you know, surprised and, you know, shake my head every now and then. Why is everyone want to talk to me and the media and so on? You know, I'm for speaking truth to anybody. I will continue to do this on behalf of my people. But please understand that at the end of the day, what I'm looking for is very simple. I want to be able to go to Jerusalem without a checkpoint. Is that too much to ask? I want to be able to go to Ramallah without a checkpoint, you know? I want to live in a place where I don't have to worry about the future for my children, whether they have a future in this land, whether they will be second-class or third-class citizens in this land. I want to live in a place where we have sovereignty and self-determination as people, where people are not treated based on their religion or nationality, but, you know, we're all equal under the same law in our homeland, because this is home to me. I don't have any other home, and I don't want to go to any other place, especially as someone who lives in Bethlehem. You know, to me it's an undeserved privilege to live in the place where Jesus was born. So I want to continue living here without having to worry about incursions or about whether my children will have a job, or whether, you know, Ramal Bethlehem will become another Gaza, which is what we're heading to right now. I hope people, you know, understand how brutal things are and difficult, even in the West Bank. We're heading towards where Gaza was 17 years ago. My point is, what we're asking for is basic daily lives issue. We want to live in dignity in our land. And at the end of the day, there are 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Israeli Jews in this land. We either share it or continue to fight. And right now, Israel holds all the keys because the world keeps enabling them. They're never held in check. And as long as it's a profitable occupation, they will continue. And as long as the world is okay with the dehumanization of Palestinians, they will continue. And even when they commit such horrific genocide against Palestinians, not only they're not held accountable, they're not paying the bill. This is what, you know, people came and countries came and offered to pay the bill and provide the cover. This cannot last. This is not sustainable. And I hope this is the last cycle of violence we're engaged in. And I hope this is the last cycle of violence, because the tragedy of war, it's the vulnerable and the innocent who pay the price. And in the tragedy of Gaza, 13,000 children, 30,000 Palestinians have been killed. When will the world say enough is enough? This is my prayer and this is my hope.
My thoughts and prayers are with you. Complete solidarity with you and the Palestinian people. Reverend Manta, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
That was Reverend Dr. Manta Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, academic and activist. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.